This is Michael Shannon, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading for Arizona History. Our first story is a raucous and bawdy view of love and romance in the old Arizona. The title is Cupid's Frontier Ways. It's a knee slapper for young and old. Cupid's Frontier Ways. Finding a partner to romance wasn't easy in old Arizona. The territory was big and sparsely populated. Distances were grueling to travel, making regular socializing difficult, and eligible women were few. When one happened to arrive on the scene, she needed but two legs and about the same number of teeth to attract a crowd of suitors. Amorously ambitious men were fast to shed their chewing tobacco, their arranged breeches, abuse their bodies by standing in a cedar tub filled with alkali water and lye soap, then, with hats pressed to belly buttons, take a few deep breaths and make their play. If they were truly desperate, they might even subject themselves to some Sunday morning preaching in the hope of gaining an introduction after services. Cochise County rancher James G. Wolfe wrote that if a girl so much as smiled, cowboys would immediately invest in a suit of store clothes. With every corn aching and all dressed up in a stiff collared shirt like a government mule, they would attend the next church bazaar where they would be mulcted of all their money, buying raffle tickets, all for the sake of a new face and the opportunity to learn to curl their little finger around a teacup in the toniest manner of the day, when straight whiskey and the birdcage saloon was really their caliber. Some frontiersmen, lacking even that one shot to work their charm, turned to a method that seemed surprisingly modern, personal ads. While hardly commonplace, they were indeed used in territorial Arizona, usually by men with a flair for attracting attention. Flagstaff's Arizona Champion ran this ad July 7, 1888. Quote, "Wanted by young men of superior birth and education, but pecuniarily embarrassed. Position as son-in-law in wealthy family cattle preferred. Address with stamp to H.S. Champion." The Arizona Journal Miner, a Prescott paper, carried an appeal by a middle-aged man who wanted a slender woman with a 36-inch bust. Quote, "A little on the lazy order, with just enough ambition to keep herself clean and look after the house. She also had to have the good sense to, quote, not to be spoiled by being cared for tenderly when sick." Apparently worried about competition, the man ended his ad by saying, quote, "Ladies that may imagine themselves the least bit susceptible to being hypnotized by gentlemen rumors in a neighborhood need not apply." The corpulent William J. Berry, editor of the Arizona Sentinel of Yuma, published an appeal for his dream woman and made it clear she had to be fat. He also was eager to exchange photographs, probably to make sure that none of those sneaky, skinny ones slipped through. "If anyone don't like our way of going about this interesting business," Berry wrote in 1875, "we don't care. It's none of their funeral." When a fellow judged personal ads demeaning, his options were limited. Most headed to saloons to browse the floozies that hustled for drinks and whatever else they might turn over for a dollar or two. Wolfe landed in Charleston in 1883 and stayed more than 50 years. He occasionally scouted the saloons there and in Tombstone with the notion of finding a wife. As a cattleman, he said that he looked for husky girls, too, because they were more suited to the ways of the ranch. "Some of them could ride horses and even frisky broncs," he wrote in his memoirs. But they all shied at the sight of the woodpile and plainly murmured their opinion of ranch life when I talked about hoeing corn and milking cows. Anyway, they left me to go my own solitary way. If a man plucked a girl from the cribs in the red light district, he risked disease and a certain stigma, at least among churchgoers. George Parsons, who kept a diary of his Tombstone years in the 1880s, wrote, "How men of good family and connections east can come here and marry prostitutes, take them out of a dance house, I can't see." But when a cowboy sets his sight on a girl he didn't have to pay for, he was looking at real trouble. How does an awkward once-a-month bather with whiskers like cactus spines, a fellow more at home looking at a cow's backside than into a girl's eyes, go about wooing his favored female? Fact was, he needed help. In the late 1800s, an unknown wag recorded a few rules of courtship. Despite the flippant tone, a desperate cowboy could find helpful truths in them. First rule, agree with the girl's father in politics and religion. If you have a rival, keep an eye on him. If he is a widower, keep both eyes on him. Second, don't put too much sweet stuff on paper. If you do, you will hear it read in after years when your wife has some special purpose in inflicting upon you the severest punishment known to a married man. Number three, if on the occasion of your first call, the girl upon whom you have placed your young affections looks like an iceberg and acts like a cold wave, take your leave and stay away. Woman in her hours of breeze is uncertain, coy, and hard to please. Rule number four, don't lie about your financial condition. It is annoying for a bride who pictured for herself a life of luxury to learn too late that you expected her to ask a bald-headed parent to take you in out of the cold. Rule number five, if you sit down on some molasses candy that little Willie has left on the chair while wearing your new summer trousers for the first time, smile sweetly and remark that you don't mind sitting on molasses candy at all and that boys will be boys. Reserve your true feelings for future reference. Number six, don't be too soft. Don't say, these little hands shall never do a stroke of work when they are mine. Or, you shall have nothing to do in our home but to sit all day long and chirp to the canaries. As if any sensible woman would be happy fooling away the time in that sort of style. Rule number seven, a girl has a fine retentive memory of the soft things and silly promises of courtship, and occasionally in after years when she is washing the dinner dishes or patching the west end of your trousers, she will remind you of them in a cold, sarcastic tone of voice. Even so, a cowboy's eagerness, born of isolation and too many dreams, often bested him, and his kiss began to sound like a mule pulling a hoof out of the mud. To help befuddled cowpokes along, someone penned The Way Arizona Girls Kiss, which made the rounds in the late 1880s. The Prescott Girls bows her stately head and fixes her stylish lips in a firm, hard way and lets them go in spasmodic little snips. The Flagstaff Girl removes her specs and freezes her face with a smile and sticks out her lips like an open book, but she chews her gum meanwhile. The Holbrook Girl says never a word, and you think her rather tame, with her practical view of the matter at hand, but she gets there just the same. The Phoenix Girl, the pride of the world, in her clinging and soulful way, absorbs it all with yearnful yearn, as big as a bale of hay. A Tucson Girl gets a grip on herself as she carefully takes off her hat. Then she grabs the prize in a frenzied way, like a terrier shaking a rat. The Tempe Girls, so gentle and sweet, let their lips meet the coming kiss, with a rapturous warmth, and their soulful souls float away on the sea of bliss. We have sung the song of the girls who kiss, and it sets one's brain in a whirl. But to reach the heights of an earthly kiss, you must kiss a tombstone girl. With your arms around her waist, her face upturned, in a sweetly confiding way, you care not a cent for the whole wide world, though the wind through your whiskers play. And closer together your lips to draw, till they meet in rapturous glow, and the small boy hidden behind the fence cries, "Let her go." The tortures of finding a suitable mate didn't allay a man's natural tendency to fuss, stammer, dissemble, and delay when it came to actually declaring his intentions. He wanted companionship. Yes, but not too fast. In September 1899, the Valley Bulletin of Solomonville ran a blurb about a prairie pink who wanted her cowboy suitor to back his talk with a wedding. Taking him by the ear, she said, "Nobby, you've been fooling around this claim for mighty near a year and have never yet shut off your mouth on the marrying biz. I've cottoned to you on the square clean through and have stood off every galoot that has tried to chip in, And now I want you to come down to business or vamoose the ranch. Do the talk act or pull your freight. If you're on the carry and want a part that'll stick to you till you pass over the range, just shoot your wad and we'll hitch. But if that ain't your game, then draw out and give some other fella a show for his pile. Now sing your song or slope. Well, he sang. Territorial weddings were satirized by writers as far away as Cornwall, England. That country's Gazette newspaper published the following under the headline, Marriage in Arizona. Do you take this woman whose hand you're squeezing to be your lawful wife? In flush times and skimp? I reckon that's just about the size of it, squire. Do you take this man you've joined fists with to be your part through thick and thin? Well, about your right for once, old man. All right, then, kiss in court, and I reckon you're married as tight as the law can jine you. I guess 4 bits will do it, Bill, if I don't kiss the bride. If I do, it's 6 bits extra. But the real thing was often better than satire. A double horseback wedding took place in the Tonto Basin in 1890. When the parson finished his book reading, Charlie Meadows, brother of one of the brides, Maggie Meadows, announced one of the nuptial gifts. The couple could keep every head of cattle they could find and brand between that moment and sundown. The chase was at once begun, reported the Arizona Journal Miner. The young women, who are expert riders, carrying the branding irons and assisting in tying down the cattle. A large number of the wedding guests followed and highly enjoyed the sport. Each couple secured 18 head of stock. Men and women lucky enough to find each other weren't always in the same place where the urge to marry became unbearable. In that case, they sometimes wed by telegraph. Early in 1885, newspapers told of the wire wedding of O. McGrew, all dressed up and alone in Prescott with Miss Corey Peaver in the same condition in Vive, Indiana. In June 1887, L.R. Root and Carmelita Garcia rushed into the telegraph office in San Carlos and asked the operator to send an urgent request for someone to tie the silken cord. With a justice of the peace on hand in Globe and a bride and groom in San Carlos, the two lovers were made one in the flesh through electricity. But poor Carmelita was so flustered she kissed the telegraph operator instead of her new husband. Not every marriage worked out, of course. Joshua Bailey's pledged union with Maggie Patterson collapsed before it even came off. Bailey arranged to host a huge reception in a warehouse next to his Safford Mercantile. A festive table was laid out with cakes, pies, and choice of cuts of beef, and in each corner of the enormous room stood barrels of wine and whiskey with tin cups handy. Of course, as the host, the bridegroom couldn't very well leave his guests unattended, so he took a swallow with each one, just to be sociable, and before long he was horizontal. So deep was his sleep, according to Graham County author Ryder Ridgway, that Bailey couldn't be resurrected. His handsome young clerk, Peter Brewer, not wanting to disappoint the assembled guests, not to mention the waiting bride, stood in for his boss at the wedding ceremony. When Bailey, considered the father of the eastern Arizona town of Stafford, finally sat up in the next morning and drew a sober breath, he was introduced to the new Mrs. Brewer. Prescott's Journal Miner devoted considerable space to territorial divorce news. The paper headlined its column in that plain-spoken, no-nonsense manner so typical of the frontier mind. They called it Miserable Marriages. It made darn good reading, complete with sly references and smart-aleck remarks. In 1893, Rachel Packard alleged desertion in her effort to divorce W.A. Packard. Their marriage, the paper noted, took place the year before in Prescott and had been jumped up rather suddenly. But in a short while, W.A. had sold his business and departed for the northwest part of the country, promising to settle and send for his wife and family later. That was the last Rachel ever heard from him. It was another case of trusting women and deceitful men, the paper reported, for the longed-for letter never came. It is not known whether he picked up some other women on his route or not. Neither is it known how many wives he has had in some other climate. Anyway, Mrs. Packard wants to be absolved from her legal connection with him. One of the better items that Miserable Marriages reported the following year concerned the marital distress of Catherine E. Wormell. The lady sued her husband for divorce, alleging that his domestic eccentricities had become too much to bear. The final straw was her husband kicking her out of bed and into the night. Evidently, Mr. Wormell had become discouraged, in the words of the Journal Miner, after a 2 weeks industrial attempt to destroy the saloon business in the valley by a consumption of the stock on hand. He came to realize the utter powerlessness of one lone, unaided man to put down the shameful traffic, and he seemed to blame his wife for the failure. That brings us to the end of our first story titled Cupid's Frontier Ways. Our next story is titled Odd and Bizarre People Make Historical Footnotes. The most miserable marriage of all, and certainly the most entertaining divorce, belonged to Mojave Indian John Oatman and his wife Estelle. They made it long past their wedding ceremony, which took place in 1903, but probably wished they hadn't. She filed for divorce 19 years later in a case that provided a public window on human weirdness. In court papers, Estelle described her husband's intolerable pastimes, including frightening her by putting phosphorus on his body and performing a tribal ghost dance, lighting matches on the bottom of his bare feet, and, in keeping with ancient Mojave custom, refusing to look at his mother-in-law. But these were mere trifles compared with John's other hobbies. He enjoyed eating local weed, and in the dementia that followed, once tied Estelle to the topmost prickly branches of a 25-foot-high candelabra cactus, leaving her there during a scorching hot afternoon. In a mine explosion on the northwest Arizona gold town of Oatman in 1916, John lost most of his scalp, his teeth, and one of his eyes. Ever since then, Estelle complained that he delighted in removing his false teeth, popping out his glass eye, and scalping himself by removing his wig, frightening his own children and those of the tribe. John also was having an affair with an albino Yavapai girl who swam across the Colorado River to tryst with him. When Estelle complained, he dug a covered pit, filled it with Gila monsters, lizards, scorpions, tarantulas, and rattlesnakes, and shoved her into it. Moreover, Estelle said that John, who claimed to be the grandson of the famed Olive Oatman, a white woman held captive by the Mojaves for 5 years in the 1850s, spent most of their money buying glass eyes from a Los Angeles optical goods house. But he lost them at poker, and the optical house refused to extend further credit. So, for several weeks before appearing in court in April 1922, John wore no artificial eye at all and walked around a ghastly hole in his head. Another contentious issue involved the previous division of community property. In order to get his half of the household furniture, John sawed one table, three chairs, and a chest of drawers into and hauled away his half. Estelle acknowledged, however, that sometime later, when she and John had temporarily reconciled, her husband gallantly attempted to nail the furniture back together again. John Oatman's antics received lengthy attention in the pages of the Arizona Republican, no doubt providing readers with great enjoyment. But his divorce is the only reason his name is still spoken. Like many other characters from Arizona's early days, he is remembered not for the totality of his life, but for one act or trait, whether silly, grotesque, or good. The name of Miner, Charlie Rose, for example, would have quietly faded if not for his somewhat overdeveloped sense of personal honor. In November 1898, the Yavapai County Miner was convicted and sentenced to life in the Yuma pen for killing two Mexicans who stole his burros. Charlie was such a model inmate that 3 years later, prison officials circulated a petition asking the governor for his release. When the Arizona Journal Miner, Prescott's influential newspaper, took up his cause, Governor N.O. Murphy responded by granting Charlie parole effective October 8, 1901, but he refused to take it, saying only a full pardon would do. The standoff ended when guards escorted Charlie off the property, the only time in history of the notorious territorial prison that a man was forced to leave. Jack McKay was a good liveryman and scout, tempered with whiskey and tight with money, but he is remembered only for his speech impediment. In the 1930s, the Arizona Pioneers Historical Society received in the mail a series of letters about the life in the territory in 1880s written by an old prospector who wished to remain anonymous. One letter told how Jack, when he got hung up on a word or phrase, would mutter an expression that seemed to help him get going again. It had no meaning, at least not to anyone other than Jack, and its exact phrasing varied from begad or washal to its reverse, washal, begad. Sometimes he used it one way and sometimes the other. Once when getting off the train at Casa Grande, Jack met the anonymous letter writer and after shaking hands said, "Don't you know, begad, washal, I'm glad to see you and yet I ain't." "How's that, Jack?" asked the man. "Well, don't you know, begad, washal, if I had a quarter, I'd take you over and treat you, but by God, we shall, maybe you have one." When a man with a similar speech impediment came to town, Jack heard him talking and noticed that when his fellow got stuck for a word, he started whistling. Jack stopped, listened, and walked in a circle around the stranger, sizing him up. As the man finally got through whistling and finishing his sentence, Jack said, "Don't you know, we shall, be God, I'm sorry for that fellow." Men like Jack McKay are not the subject of long academic papers or books. They're usually mentioned only in blurbs tucked away in the corners of old newspapers or in a paragraph from the memoirs of some aging pioneer who sat down decades later to record his story. Judge John J. Hawkins, formerly of Prescott, was living in Los Angeles in 1932 when he wrote his reminiscences. One of his prominent characters was an affable bearded ex-Confederate named Robert Groom. A surveyor who laid out the territorial capital of Prescott found it in 1863. But no one remembers that historical trifle. Groom is instead recalled for ending the practice of dueling in Arizona. He did so, according to Hawkins, by drinking too much, his passion, and getting into bitter arguments with some young army officer from nearby Fort Whipple. The soldiers took great offense at something Groom had said and challenged him to a duel, and he was no doubt so full of bug juice that he accepted. Groom agreed to select the weapons and the fighting ground, a secluded spot on the flats between Kirkland and Walnut Grove. Surviving accounts do not record Groom's thoughts upon waking up the next morning and realizing the mess he was in. But we can assume by subsequent events that he turned his brain inside out to find a way out. When the officers showed up, looking crisp and professional in their uniforms, they saw Groom holding two long-handled wooden paddles, and at the sight of the proposed duel, a long-dead, horribly smelly bull on its back, its legs pointing straight in the air. The fight would not involve pistols. As Groom explained to the stunned-off soldiers, the winner would be the man who shoveled the most guts out of the dead bull with a paddle. But no contest took place. The air was so putrid that the soldiers forgot their anger and fled before the stench killed him, leaving Groom smiling with his paddles. Hawkins said whenever the subject of dueling came up thereafter, the combatants would recall Groom's unique solution. It caused a good laugh, he wrote, and brought on another drink, and everyone would be friends again. Dr. Warren Erasmus Day performed bravely as an army surgeon out of Fort Verde in 1874, once riding 22 miles at night through snow and bitter cold to save the life of 2nd Lieutenant Charles King, shot in the arm by Apaches. But he is best remembered for one wild episode in Prescott in 1880. The good doctor, a notorious drunk, was enjoying an evening on the town with Justice of the Peace Henry Fleury, another stellar civic specimen who happened to be keeping domestic with a local prostitute, Ella Howard. Probably as a means of getting her out of his house, Fleury decided that Day and Ella should be married, and she was summoned. The judge, wobbling, slurring, and drunk as a lord, performed the ceremony, joining his live-in lover in legal matrimony with Prescott's best-known doctor. What was plainly a lark turned serious 7 years later when some of Day's enemies, pulling strings in Prescott and Washington, D.C., had him arrested for polygamy. It turned out that 7 months after his drunken wedding, long after Ella had left the area, Day met and married Jeanette Gordon. The two stayed together for almost 45 years and produced 10 children. The doctor stood trial on the polygamy charge of 1889, and the jury needed only 15 minutes to find him guilty. In what clearly was a foolish abuse of everyone's time, Day was given 2 years in the Yuma pen, but served only 6 months, thanks to President Benjamin Harrison, who commuted the sentence. The surest sign of a frontier character was a nickname. Having one wasn't simply necessary, it was essential. And more direct and insulting, the better. A Phoenix merchant traveled under the moniker of Fatty Asher, but his defining trait wasn't size. He was considered Arizona's champion snorer. Tucson pioneer Herbert Rockman said Fatty blew his horn so loud that when he was on a train, passengers on separate cars could hear it. When the schedule between Phoenix and Tucson called for a night's layover in Maricopa Junction, wrote Rockman, and if people knew Fatty would be on that train, they changed their minds and took the next one. Then there was Cyclone Bill, born William Ederson Beck. He was a sometime lawyer, political dandy, and small-time crook with one short leg, said to have been damaged by a bullet, came in handy when he wanted to buy drinks for the house. Amid a saloon full of big hats, he'd stand on his little stump and order the round for everyone. While the bartender was preparing them, Bill would take a step back and stand up on his good leg, which made him considerably taller. The bartender would serve the drinks, then look around for Bill to collect his money, but he couldn't recognize him and say, "Where's that sawed-off SOB who ordered the drinks?" That brings us to the end of the last story about odd and bizarre people. This is Michael Shannon, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this has been the reading of Arizona History. If you missed a program, you can get it on demand at the Sun Sounds website, www.sunsounds.org. Click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Scroll down to the programming links and choose On Demand Broadcasts. Sun Sounds is also available on your smart home device.